This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you live on March the 24th. And I'm back. Thank you for putting up with my being gone Thursday and Friday. And a tip of the hat to Peter B. Collins for filling in for me. We had a best of on Thursday. Wednesday, after our flight back from the Darfur region of southern Sudan, or the edge of the Darfur region of southern Sudan. It was just an incredibly long flight back, and I got home and at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday morning, and we did our show on Wednesday. And you'll recall I said I'm living on Robitussin and have been for a week, and went home that afternoon and just suddenly got the chills so bad with all my clothes on, crawled under the blankets and couldn't stop shaking, my teeth chattering, and then started barfing my guts out and just totally melted down. And the doc had given me some, and my fever spiked at about 103, and the travel doctor before I left had given me some doxycycline in addition to the malaria medication and said, you know, just in case anything else happens. And I thought, okay, this is anything else. And so I started taking it, and it knocked it down, and I've since talked with my physician, and he said, you had a really severe case of pneumonia. And so I am living on doxycycline, but I'm living. I'm back, so glad to be back here with you. Today, we're going to talk with Richard Cizik in the next segment, the vice president of the National Association of Evangelicals. Right now, on the same issue, right now, George Landreth is with us. He's the president of Frontiers of Freedom. FF.org is their website. Evangelical and conservative leaders, seems to be a bit of a schism here among evangelicals, as according to Frontiers of Freedom, evangelical and conservative leaders have urged Congress to defeat climate change legislation. And George Landreth, first of all, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you.
Thank you, George.
Sorry you haven't been feeling well, but I'm glad you seem to be on the mend.
Yeah, well, flying back from Africa and the whole trip there, I guess I'm not as young as I thought, as I used to be, shall we say. But anyway, thank you for your well wishes. Why would conservative evangelicals be opposed to climate change legislation? Are we not, as not just Christians, I would say, Jews, Muslims, Hindu, I mean, right across the board, as people who may consider themselves the children of God or even the gods, are we not called by God to be good stewards of the planet rather than good stewards of the wealthy?
Absolutely. I think that's critically important, and that's a biblical perspective that matters. The problem with the climate change regulations that Congress is contemplating is that they will cost people, families, for example, between $5,000 and $7,000 annually beginning by 2020. And then on top of that, they'll produce virtually no climate benefit at all. And example is the cap and trade system that they're contemplating putting in place is now in place in Europe. In Europe, the last several years, they've increased their carbon output by 3.8% annually, even though their population isn't growing and their economy isn't growing.
First of all, assuming that your numbers are legitimate, and of course, as you well know, people on the other side are saying, no, sorry, that's not right. But let's just assume for a moment that they are. Are you suggesting that the people in New Orleans, the people in the Midwest right now who are suffering from massive flooding, the people across equatorial Africa, where I was last week, who are seeing the desert moving at a rate of, in some cases, 100 miles a year now, massive global changes in ecosystems as a consequence of global climate change, that those people are not already paying a significant price for this, A, and B, that that these kinds of changes that we're looking at, I mean, why should we be so defeatist and negative about it? Isn't this an extraordinary opportunity for us to break our addiction to foreign oil, to break our addiction to giving money to the family of Osama bin Laden and his buddies, and start investing in things like solar power, wind power, wave power, geothermal power right here in the United States?
Well, we are investing in those things, and I think that's fine. But the problem I think we have to realize is that technology is going to be the way that solves this problem. It's not going to be legislation. I mean, for example, there was a time when we used whale oil to light our homes, and there were people who at the time probably thought that was, you know, not environmentally friendly and perhaps immoral to be, you know, killing whales so we could light our homes. But Congress didn't fix that problem. Technology did. And I think that...
Actually, I would argue to a large extent Congress did help fix that problem, in as much as Congress appropriated hundreds of millions of dollars, in which in today's terms would be hundreds of billions of dollars, to build the railroads that facilitated the development and the growth of the giant oil companies. I mean, without the railroad infrastructure,
right.
John Rockefeller's Standard Oil Trust never would have existed.
Well, right, but electricity became the way we really ended up lighting our homes.
Right, and then Franklin Roosevelt came along with the Rural Electrification Administration,
right,
and said, you know, you guys don't want to run electricity into the rural communities. We're going to, A, on the one hand, force you to, and in the areas where we can't force you to, we will pay for it.
Right.
The government has a long history of supporting modern technology.
The government can't help expand technology. I'm not suggesting they can't, but they don't develop it. They're always late on the arrival, is my point.
And so excuse me, but that's the whole argument that the military-industrial complex makes, is that they're at the forefront of most major technological developments. They developed the nuclear bomb, which is now atomic power.
Right.
They developed a whole series of substances which were used for outer space and whatnot that
right.
became things like nylon and polyester and that we use for clothing. The military, government has been at the forefront.
Right.
And in fact, the vast majority of pharmaceuticals, like the drug I'm taking right now that may have even saved my life, heaven only knows, the vast majority of the research into pharmaceuticals in the United States is funded by the National Institutes of Health, which is paid for by government.
Well, I don't know that the vast majority of the research is done.
It's over 80%, sir.
The vast majority of the research that's done, as I understand it, is actually private money. But
no, it's not.
I don't deny the government puts a lot of money into those things. But the truth of the matter is, if you look at the example is Congress just recently in its energy bill mandated that we switch to compact fluorescent light bulbs. That's fine. I did that 4 years ago. I didn't need an act of Congress to do that for me. I decided I was going to do that. But 20 years from now, someone's going to kind of give Congress the credit for that big change. And the truth is, those light bulbs existed, and when they became inexpensive enough that we could afford them, we started buying them. And
but when I lived in Vermont, there were you know, a lot of people. This was 6-8 years ago. A lot of people who could not afford to make that change.
Right.
As a consequence of legislation that Howard Dean pushed through in Vermont, you could go into a store and for 49 cents you could buy compact fluorescent light bulbs. I think it was an even dollar.
Yeah.
And you had to fill out a form that mm-hmm. allowed the hardware store to recover
right.
the additional $5
right.
from the state. And
that's fine, but I did it without. I didn't live there, and I didn't.
Well, you know, you and I have the luxury of the wealth of doing that. But
well,
that's.
I don't know that I'm wealthy. I'm very middle class. But the bottom line is, I made a decision, and so what I'm trying to suggest to you is that there is this propensity for Congress to come along after the fact and say, you know, compact fluorescent bulbs and crown them, and then they act like they did it, when in fact it was happening and it was a market decision, and as they became cheaper, they became more prevalent, and now there's a whole aisle at your local Lowe's or your local Home Depot. And
how do you respond to I understand, and you're right. How do you, you're right that they're proliferating, and they're proliferating in large response to consumer demand, and a good thing it is. How do you, though, reply to the argument that it sounds in your essentially denying that climate change is a man-made phenomena and whatnot, that you're basically just carrying water for the fossil fuel industry, for the oil companies and the coal companies?
Yeah, well, I mean, the truth is, if you look at if you take an historical perspective of climate, the changes we've seen of late, are within the norms of historical, you know, fluctuation. And secondly, just this week, there have been several articles published by scientists who suggest that that climate change in terms of warming stopped about 2000, a little before, like 1999, and there's a study just released about the ocean and how the ocean has been cooling ever so slightly in the last 6 or 8 years.
Yeah, well, there was a great cooling that happened in the 1950s, too, and that happened as a consequence of the industrialization of the world in the 1930s and 40s, throwing enormous amounts of soot up into the air, reflecting sunlight. And we've seen now the industrialization over the last 6, 8 years, 10 years of China and India. And again, I mean, here in Portland, Oregon, we're getting toxic rain from China's pollution. So you don't think that could be a factor?
Well, I don't believe that's the reason for this, because if you look at, for example, in the United States, our air quality is increasing and getting better every year.
Okay. Sir, we'll have to leave it at that. People can check out your website, ff.org, Frontiers of Freedom. George Landreth, the president, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American male. Soul-saving, flag-waving, brush-loving, land-paving, personal friends to the quail. Quite diligently, working so hard to keep the free
brains of this. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Conservative Christians keeping us away from tree-hugging liberals. Well, as a Christian myself, I don't quite see it that way. And I'm pleased to see that the National Association of Evangelicals, which more recently was headed up by Ted Haggard even, is not as well. Reverend Richard Cizik is with us. He is the Vice President for Government Relations of the National Association of Evangelicals. NAE.net is their website. And Reverend, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you for being with us. This dichotomy that was expressed in the bumper song that came in of you know, conservative white guys, basically Christian conservative white guys, trying to protect America from the tree-hugging liberals. This is breaking down pretty fast, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a slow-moving earthquake, Tom. It's astonishing to the old guard, that is the old order, those that are for the status quo forever. It's astonishing to them that it's happening so quickly, and yet that's exactly what's happening. And frankly, it has implications not only theologically for the church and for America's environmental policies, but it has implications for this fall's election, too. So it has all kinds of import, and we'll see what happens. But believe me, it is happening, and it is congregational-based, and yet it's primarily not political. It's theological and spiritual.
We had George Landreth on in the last segment, the president of Frontiers of Freedom, talking about how evangelical leaders were urging Congress to defeat climate change legislation because there ain't no such thing as climate change, and plus it's going to hurt the economy. To paraphrase him, I think accurately. I'm not being critical of what he had to say. And I asked him the question, and I'll ask you this question. Are we not called on by God to be, or to paraphrase nature, or paraphrase Jefferson, nature's God, as he referred in the Declaration of Independence, at the very least, to be good stewards of the planet rather than good stewards of the wealthy?
Oh, absolutely. The irony of it is, since the very beginning, this was God's mandate. It wasn't a request, Tom. It wasn't even a suggestion. It was a command in the scriptures directly from Genesis. But you find it all the way from Genesis to the last book of the Bible, namely Revelation. You find this teaching that we are to be caretakers of the earth and not simply dominionists. Those who say, hey, we belong to God, but that means we can do anything with the earth, with the physical
right.
nature of our being. And though there are those you see who are and have a vested interest in the status quo and say evangelicals will rise up to defeat anything on climate, that's simply false. The reality is that even among self-described evangelicals in polls, 84% now say they will support climate legislation, indeed even a mandatory cap on greenhouse gas emissions. So if somebody's out there predicting that evangelicals are going to defeat anything on climate, well, they are smoking something.
The National Association of Evangelicals represents some 30 million people, does it not?
Well, absolutely, but it's not just the NAE. You have the Pope coming to America shortly, and he will be speaking about this ethic of stewardship called creation care. And now you have leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention, including the current president, Dr. Frank Page, as well as presidents like Jack Graham, all saying, look, we don't even agree with our own Southern Baptist statement on this. And so,
Look, it is... Which in large part was crafted by Jerry Falwell, as I recall.
Well, it was crafted by the climate skeptics, that's for sure.
Yeah, and so the era of... I just find this fascinating, that the era of the Ted Haggards of the world, and not just to pick on him because he was high profile humiliation, but of the conservative, I don't want to pick on somebody who's around right now, but of those who are conflating corporatist and what some would call conservative economic positions and climate denial, climate change denial, with religion, using a religious pretext for this and preaching it from the pulpit. Whether it's in the Southern Baptist Convention or among evangelical churches, that they're being marginalized, they're being pushed to the edge, to the outside.
Yeah, Kevin Phillips, in his book Theocracy in America just a few years ago, theorized, you see, there was a collaboration between Southern religion and big oil. And while there are some indications of that, I'm not into conspiracy. The reality, though, is that the old order, those that were doing this, are simply passing from the scene. Now, some have died, such as the late Dr. Jerry Falwell, and others are, frankly, having to confront a new evangelical movement that is merging both a respect for science as well as what's occurring to the climate without, you see, capitulating to the evolutionary hypothesis that many scientists ascribe to. So it is a new day, and we're simply saying as evangelical Christians, we have an ethic come straight from God, and we have to take this seriously, and we are. And it is very significant because never before has the church in America realized its responsibility.
I think it's a marvelous thing, and I honor what you're doing and congratulate you for it, sir. Reverend Richard Cizik, the Vice President, Government Relations of the National Association of Evangelicals, NAE.net. Sir, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
28 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
There's no business like oil business, like no business I know. Everything about it is so thrilling. Buying up the Congress, Mr. Crown. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling like when you're drilling that Arctic well. There are no people like oil people. They smile when it does blow. Withholding technology, they know it's all. OPEC strains a hold on the oil. They only care that their earnings do not fall, so their profits will grow.
Ah, yes, their profits will continue to grow. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And strange news on the wire services, as we like to say. Yes, this is a Jaws alert. President George W. Bush confirmed today that his gutting of the Endangered Species Act is part of a broader plan to phase out the environment entirely by the time he leaves office in January of 2009. In addition to cutting taxes, it has been the goal of this administration to cut our wasteful, bloated environment, Mr. Bush said in a speech before the Association of Indiscriminate Applauders in Washington, D.C. In his speech, Mr. Bush added that the EPA would henceforth be renamed the Environmental Prevention Agency. The president said that by removing endangered species from the protected list one by one, his administration has been able to phase out the environment gradually, quote, so that hardly anyone will notice it's missing. But the president warned, much work remains to be done if the environment is to be completely phased out by the first quarter of next year, and called for the accelerated extinction of all superfluous organisms by the end of fiscal 2008. Mr. Bush said, It is time for all Americans to take sides. Are you with us or are you with the black-tailed prairie dog? Mr. Bush's plan also calls for a gradual reduction of air and water, with water most likely to get the axe. As Stephen L. Johnson of the Environmental Protection Agency chief said, if it comes down to choosing between air and water, the president will probably scrap water. After all, most Iraqis have been without water since 2003, and look how well they're doing. Elsewhere, after Pope Benedict the 16th, prayed for peace on Easter Sunday, Vice President Dick Cheney requested equal time for war. From Andy Borowitz, our good friend Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, used with permission, and good on you, Andy. But it's what he's talking about is this actual serious story. And since we're talking about this, the war on science, and just the general insanity that has infected the corporate-owned Republican Party. This from the Washington Post, the Sunday Washington Post. The Bush administration officials have made it substantially more difficult to designate domestic animals and plants for protection under the Endangered Species Act. She points out the documents show that personnel were barred from using information in agency files that might support new listings, and that senior officials, these would be political appointees, and that senior officials repeatedly dismissed the views of scientific advisors as President Bush's appointees either rejected putting imperiled plants and animals on the list or sought to remove this federal protection. This has put decisions in limbo by blocking citizen petitions that create legal deadlines. Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne has not declared a single native species as threatened or endangered since he was appointed nearly 2 years ago. In a sign of how contentious the issue has become, Juliet writes in yesterday's Washington Post, the advocacy group Wild Earth Guardians, I'm skipping around in the article here, filed a lawsuit Wednesday seeking a court order to protect 681 Western species all at one time. But some species have already vanished. The Lake Samish Kokanee, a landlocked sockeye salmon, went extinct in 2001 after being denied an emergency listing. And genetically pure Columbia Basin pygmy rabbits disappeared last year after the Interior Department declined to protect critical habitat for that species. And so on it goes. You know, the war against science, which ultimately is a war against humanity, as well as a war against all of the life out there, is just rolling along with the Bush administration. And a bizarre thing it is. This from this morning's British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC. Halliburton plans move to Dubai. And apparently they're quite a ways down the road here, not paying any federal taxes, not having to keep records for more than a year, not having oversight problems, converting to euros. Halliburton, the oil services the subhead of the article in the BBC today, Halliburton, the oil services company formerly headed by U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney, is moving its headquarters from Texas to Dubai. And in 2006, they made profits of $2.3 billion and revenues of $22.6 billion. And amazing. They will keep offices in Houston, but the posts of the chairman, president, and chief executive will be based in Dubai. So on rolls the train, right? On it rolls. It's totally strange. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Rick in Grand Rapids. Hey, Rick. Listening to TKG. I'm getting better. I'm still taking my malaria meds here.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering what happened. Did you catch that when you went to the stand?
Well, I don't know. You know, after I got so sick, it was first when I was starting to get sick, we called the doctor's office and said, can I get in? And it was around a little after 4 o'clock, and they said, no, we can't see you today. I mean, we're the best healthcare system in the world, right?
Well,
and so then that night I took the doxycycline, and that seemed to break the fever, and I made it through the night, although I was having a horrible time breathing. I'd been coughing like crazy for a week.
Well,
and then I called the doctor, and I said, do you think I had malaria or pneumonia? And he said, no, it's clearly pneumonia. He said, you won't know if you have malaria or not until you stop taking your malaria medication, which is going to be on Tuesday. So, tomorrow.
My advice to you, and you can do what you want, but I would stay away from third world countries for more than one reason.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time with them. Ironically, I'm still coughing a bit. Ironically, I think that this thing that has become pneumonia is a bug that Louise and I picked up on the Air America cruise, and I had just been carrying around for 2 weeks, and I carried it with me to Africa. I don't think I was coughing before I left,
right.
So it just I just got run down basically.
Well, anyway, I did want to say I hope you had a nice Easter. And,
thank you. We do.
But getting to this environment thing, especially in the context of people who are supposedly Christians and, you know, believe in the scriptures. There's one verse, and I don't know exactly where it is. I think it's in Jeremiah. And it might not have been talking about the environment, but it does say that God will bring to ruin those ruining the earth. And you probably...
I shall destroy those who have destroyed the earth, is the phrase.
But, you know, you probably hear this quite a bit. Unfortunately, there are some Christians that think the earth is just some kind of a way station and we're all going to heaven anyway, and it doesn't matter. But it seems to me that if you have any kind of even rudimentary belief in a creator, it stands to reason that that creator would not want the inhabitants of this planet to trash it. You know?
Right, and if you don't have a belief in the creator, it still equally stands to reason that you don't want to trash it. I mean, this transcends even religion.
This is our home.
Yeah, exactly. Rick, your point is well made, and thank you very much for calling and making it. I appreciate it. Tim in Detroit, Michigan, WDTW. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind?
Well, welcome back, Tom, and hopefully you won't have a malaria and you'll get better.
Yeah, I think I'm fine.
Let me say, this is very dicey stuff, but if one takes the supposition that the oceans, in fact, are cooling, and one explanation you kind of alluded to was that the sulfuric acid rains might be responsible for the global dimming and so on.
Well, actually, the particulate matter that's being thrown into the air by all this, I mean, the amount of coal being burned in China now has I forget the percentage, but it's, you know, hundreds of percent increase over the last 20 years, and much of it over the last 10 years. And that creates what's called an albedo effect, which is where as the atmosphere becomes thicker with particulate crud, it reflects more sunlight out. The sunlight doesn't reach the earth, and so it doesn't warm the earth. So you have this temporary cooling, as we had, as I said, in the 1950s.
And even the 70s. But I also wanted to bring up...
Yeah, through the 70s.
Brought up by some models that I've seen also that since there's been so much warming for the last, and we'll just say from 58 on, the International Geophysical Year, that there's been so much cooling. The ice has melted so much that it's actually cooled the seawater. That might also be responsible in part
for the ocean. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, glacier melting and iceberg shear off and everything else. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. That just like with the proverbial gin and tonic. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, thank you very much. Good to hear from you, Tim. I appreciate the call. Bob in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hey, Bob.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
You read that thing? You thought that was funny, right? About phasing out the environment?
Well, you know, Andy Borowitz, but it's funny and it's tragic, actually, because there's a grain of truth to it, which is, you know, the case with good comedy.
You know, remember George Bush blew all that acreage down in Paraguay?
Yep. I remember reading the news reports about it. I don't know to what extent they're true. I've read numerous news reports that the Bush family has bought hundreds of thousands of acres in Paraguay, yeah.
Yeah, but you know what's under that, hundred thousands of acres?
Oil?
Water. It's the large, no, not oil, water.
Oh, water, yeah.
It's the largest water aquifer in the Western Hemisphere. So when he runs out of selling oil, he'll be selling water.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, now I get it. Bob, thank you very much. Amazing. Kyle in San Rafael. Hey, Kyle, got about a half a minute before the break. What's up?
Well, just real quick,
about a minute,
as a longtime fan, I certainly wish you had led off with the Richardson endorsement, and I hope you'll get to that in the next hours, because this is big, and I want to urge you to start considering taking a side on the issue and going Obama, because Richardson has had a moment, I would have to say a profile and courage moment. Here's a guy who was on the inside, watched the Super Bowl. You know the drill.
Watched the Super Bowl with Bill Clinton. Yeah.
Yes.
No, I've met Bill Richardson and sat and talked with him, and I'm very impressed by the man's intellect and by his emotional what would you call it, character, you know, the quality of the man.
And Tom, we've got to make a decision. We've got to make it quick.
I agree. This is destroying the party. This is destroying the party. And I don't frankly see, well, I don't know. I was At some point soon, and this is what Bill Richardson was calling for, in my opinion. I mean, it happened right here in Portland. I watched it on TV. At some point soon, the adults have to step in and say, okay, enough. We're not going to destroy the party over this thing. 45 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
A sane voice in the wilderness of when we called our representatives, but they fixed the game and lied about the score. Well, this I know.
This I know.
Well, this I know.
Yes, I know.
Well, humanity may have never sunk so low. Well, there might be a solution. Let's bring on a revolution.
Yeah, the ruling oligarchy's got to go. At this moment, the mayor of Detroit is holding a press conference about the allegations that he and apparently the woman he was having an affair with both lied under oath about having the affair because they've got the 14,000 salacious emails between the two of them. I'm not sure what he's going to do. Perhaps he's going to resign. But up until this point, he had not resigned. Now, lying under oath is actually a fairly substantial crime. It's a major felony. And particularly in that kind of an inquiry, Elliot Spitzer, I think that there's a growing opinion in the United States that Elliot Spitzer should not have resigned as mayor of New York. Yes, it is illegal to hire prostitutes in the United States. Many of us believe that, at least under these kind of circumstances, truly consenting adults. Obviously, there is a sex trade that is literally a slavery trade, and parts of it are operating in the United States as well as all around the world. But that certainly is not what Governor Spitzer was involved with. That and he was using his own money, that he should not have resigned. And I'll just put it out that that's my opinion. I don't think he should have resigned, although apparently the Republicans in the legislature of New York were getting ready to impeach him. But here's where it gets really interesting. This guy, Roger Stone, Republican political operative down in Florida, this is in the Miami Herald this morning, almost 4 months before Governor Elliot Spitzer resigned in a sex scandal, a lawyer for Republican political operative Roger Stone sent a letter to the FBI alleging that Spitzer, quote, used the services of high-priced call girls, end quote, while in Florida. Stone, known for shutting down the 2000 presidential election recount effort in Miami-Dade County, is a longtime Spitzer nemesis whose political experience ranges from the Nixon White House to Al Sharpton's presidential campaign. So this is a guy who has made a living professionally hitting Democrats. So I find that fascinating. I find that absolutely fascinating. And the president of the European Union, by the way, is now saying that maybe the EU should get on the bandwagon and say, if China will not open talks to the Dalai Lama about at least a quasi-independence for Tibet, that maybe the EU should boycott the Olympics. And good on Nancy Pelosi, by the way, for heading over there. I think that's marvelous. And, yes, I believe that the endorsement by Bill Richardson of Barack Obama over the weekend is huge. I heard a commentator this morning, a news commentator, say that he was loving the fact that these primaries, this Democratic primary is dragging on and on and on, and that now they're talking about, you know, let's go all the way through Indiana, let's go all the way through Oregon, May 6th election, May 20th Oregon, as I recall. And he said, I've never had a better time in my life, and I just cringed. I am watching the electoral chances of this party, the Democratic Party, in November decline day by day, and I am watching candidates beat each other up. By and large, one candidate beat another up. I think that Hillary Clinton's primary strategy actually, I'm not even sure it's her strategy. I think it's Mark Penn's strategy, is the kill the baby seal strategy. You know, bloody Barack Obama to the point where everybody's going to say, well, nobody would ever vote for him, and so I guess we have to pick her, even though there's no possible way she can have more delegates than he going into the convention. No possible way. I mean, it's mathematically impossible right now. And I will submit to you that were it not for her association with Bill Clinton and the Clinton administration, you know, her past, her last name, that this would not be the situation, that if the tables were turned, that if Hillary Clinton was out ahead in delegates, if she was ahead in numeric votes, if she was ahead in states won, that there would be a loud hue and cry for Barack Obama to resign, and he probably, or to pull out of the race, and he would probably be forced to do so. So, I am saddened to see the whole thing going on. I'm still of the opinion, however, and I'm gonna hold to this, that if Hillary Clinton is our nominee, she will make a good president. She may make a great president. And that if Barack Obama is our nominee, he will certainly make a great president. And I will vote for either one of them. And, you know, we have to let the will of the voters play this thing out, and the voters and the superdelegates. So I'm not going to become partisan on this issue. But that's my observation of it at this point. Bob in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Bob.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning,
afternoon, Bob. Whatever. First off, let me welcome you back. We missed you.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're feeling better.
Thank you.
But you know, right now I am sick to my stomach as far as this politics is concerned. Ever since this so-called Reverend Wright has opened up his big mouth in the wrong way.
Well, he opened up his big mouth back in 2003. He's no longer he hasn't even been the pastor of the church for a year and a half.
Well, I'm talking about what I know about, what I feel like I know about.
Mm-hmm.
I think what the Democrat has done since he opened up his mouth, they really has given the Republican the nomination and on a silver platter. Because they're not going to stop talking about this thing. They're going to take it all the way into the convention. And it seemed like each day. Now, Obama, I'm like you. I would vote for either one of them, but I just don't see how either one of them are going to win the election at this point. Because first off, they're like two horses pulling against each other. One pull up, and then the other one pull them back, and the next one will pull up and back and forth like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole thing just scares me to no end.
Yeah, there's a good article. Bob, we're out of time for the hour, but your point well made. The New Republic has an excellent article about this, about how the Democratic Party and the Democratic candidates are being torn apart by this process. And it's very thought-provoking, and I recommend it. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up next, Marjorie Cohn. Are we preparing for a war in Iran before the election? Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman Program. The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. I've got to share. There's a whole bunch of things I want to talk with you about today, and there's a lot going on in the news. But this is my life last week and the week before. Throughout the nighttime in the community where we were staying. This is a community, Gok Machar, South Sudan, right near the, you know, within 15, 20 miles of the Darfur border, a community that was absorbing enormous numbers of refugees from Darfur. Every night, the local community would, now keep in mind, this is 45,000 people with one well. The nearest electricity was 300-400 miles away. The nearest paved road was probably 500 miles away. There was absolutely no infrastructure at all. No roads, no sewage, no electricity. The buildings were mud huts with thatched roofs that get wiped out every year when the rainy season comes. And they're absorbing all these refugees, and this is, you know, we were there to see what was going on with the situation and also to bring in, and we flew in thousands, several tons of food and supplies. And if you want to help out with that, you can still go to TomHartman.com and contribute to that effort. But anyhow, every night, this is the endurance of the human spirit. Every night, the community or part of the community would get together and build a fire and sing. This is what I went to sleep to every night. And this is a recording that my son made. He was traveling with us, Justin, and he went one night to join them, and he just sat in the circle with them and recorded this. A lot of kids, you know, involved. I mean, there's nothing else. No toys, no school, nothing. So anyhow, that's part of that story. And then we were talking, I told you the story about how Monica, the commissioner, the county commissioner, kind of the local chief, or not chief is the wrong word, but the local head person for this community, this area. She was born and grew up in this community. A group of slaves, people who had been enslaved during the war, who had been taken north as slaves during the war, were returned, or as many of them had fled back. And one was this old man. And when he saw her, he immediately recognized her and called out her name and started telling her stories of when she was 7 years old, and that which is the year that he was taken. And she had no recollection of him. She's like, who is this guy? And I told you that story. Well, I was standing there when that happened, and I had turned on my recorder, and here is a piece of it.
Was he an IDP, or had he been enslaved?
He was liberated.
He was enslaved. Now that's John. He's with CSI, the group, the charity that helped bring in the food.
Long time.
So he was enslaved for how long?
That's Ellen Ratner.
Almost 20-something years.
20-something
years. It's been that long since you've seen him. You saw him when you were a child last?
The last he left me when I was 7 years.
7 years old?
Yes.
And you won't tell us how old you are now?
Him? Maybe.
Monica's going to take a pass on that question.
40-something years. What okay was it? I'm not even really, I'm not much sure.
Is this your mother's brother or your father's?
He's my father's brother.
Your father's brother.
Yes.
He's my father's brother.
Is still alive?
No.
So he never got to see his brother?
Yes.
This must be. And did you know he was coming back today?
I don't know. I just met him suddenly now.
Just now.
I called my name Monica. Monica, are you my daughter of my brother?
Are you my what?
Hey,
Monica talking for a second. So he called you just now?
Yes.
He recognized you.
And someone showed him to me. He said, "Do you know that man?" I said, "No, I don't know." And he's called me by my name.
He needs to get this. We're having a hard time with the audio, so if we can just read.
So then Ellen kind of redoes the interview, but that is a fascinating experience. So, with regard to the economy, and I want to get into this in some detail in particular, perhaps, in the first hour of our program tomorrow, but, Merrill Lynch, at the end of 2007, 36% of consumers' disposable income went to food, energy, and medical care, a bigger chunk of income than at any time since records were first kept. And that was back in 1960 when they first started keeping such records. But 36% just to food, energy, and medical care. Medical care is particularly hitting average American families since medical costs have increased 78% since George Bush was sworn in as president. Bill Frist's daddy and his buddies are making a friggin' fortune. And the inflation-adjusted, this from the Center for American Progress, Think Progress blog, inflation-adjusted median family income has dropped 2.6% or nearly $1,000 annually since the year 2000. So, and the number of people using payday loans is growing. These are this is a negative sign for economic recovery. These are loans with an interest rate very often as high as 800%. So, certainly not a good or healthy sign for the economy or for the country. The headline, the largest headline, speaking of the situation that I was just sharing with you from Africa, from Sudan and Darfur, but one of the things that was so clear to me, and I've been there, not in that, I've been in Uganda and Kenya before, and I was in Uganda during the war with Idi Amin in 1980 and 1981. And we took over a refugee camp, and we I saw children die of starvation right in front of me, and many of them. And it's a very difficult thing. And when we were in Gok Machar and other parts of Sudan last week and the week before, we saw the same thing. You know, the bloated bellies, the hair that has turned orange. There are medical names for these things. I think kwashiorkor is the bloated belly. The signs of severe malnutrition. Everybody, you know, with just stick-thin bones. Well, the screaming headline on today's Financial Times, which now that the Wall Street Journal is owned by Murdoch and has become kind of good news all the time, is where I turn to see how the rich folks are talking to the rich folks, at least with some honesty these days. The major headline, the top headline, UN pleads for $500 million to avoid food crisis. And when we were at Gok Machar, and we're getting together some photos for this, and I apologize that we haven't gotten them up before now, but we will have them up soon. You can see the landing strip where we landed. There are a couple of big warehouses that say WFP on them. That's the World Food Program. That's the United Nations. The United Nations is feeding this community in part, and is one of a number of agencies that are feeding this community all across the world. I mean, the World Food Program. The World Food Program, this is Javier Blas in London. The World Food Program has launched a, quote, extraordinary emergency appeal to governments to donate at least $500 million. Now, this is the amount of money that we're spending in Iraq in 2 days. To spend at least $500 million in the next 4 weeks to avoid rationing food in response to the spiraling cost of food. Now, this is a program that has an annual budget of $2.9 billion. That's how much we spend in Iraq in about a week. This is their entire annual budget. And they're asking for an emergency $500 million infusion, half a billion dollar infusion, which will take their budget up to $3.4 billion. Because the cost of food is going up, and the cost of transporting that food is going up. You know, oil at $100 a barrel, it costs so much more to fly these planes in and all these kind of things. The WFP's funding gap is now about $600 to $700 million, officials said, after a 20% jump in food costs in the past 3 weeks, the rise in the oil price of about $100 a barrel, and a surge in shipping costs. If the minimum $500 million extra funds arrive, their budget will go up. If not, quote, they will cut the rations for those who rely on the world to stand by them during times of abject need. Now, there's something worth calling your member of Congress about. Hey, the World Food Program, the UN, they need $500 million. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news.
At 6 o'clock.
President Bush's surprise message. America is addicted to...
Yep, we passed the 4,000 mark last night of American soldiers dead in Iraq. Probably well past the 400,000 mark of Iraqi civilians dead as a consequence of George Bush's decision for a politically motivated war to flip the 2002 elections. I mean, let's just call this what it was. That was the bottom line. Strange news out there. Kind of crazy, actually. These are segments my producer makes me do, as Keith Olbermann likes to say. A Phoenix homeowner said he didn't find out about a giant penis painted on the roof of his house until 6 months after it was drawn. Ryan Walker says the image of the male organ was painted by members of his band during his bachelor party 6 months ago. It's according to the Arizona Republic. I think it's hilarious, he said. If you woke up in the news and is at your house and you had a giant penis on your roof, what would you think? Neighbors were as surprised as Walker to find out about the image. Neighbor Darnell Whitfield said it was like a hit of coffee or something in the face. A penis on the roof? I was like, huh, are you serious? Walker said the story of the penis painting on his roof could be therapeutic for the United States. With the economy, with the Bear Stearns thing happening today, why not a giant penis on the roof, Walker asked. Yeah. Yeah. Why not? 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Mark in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Hey,
I've been puzzled over why we stopped with the logic about Hillary discrediting Obama so that she can get the nomination. You know, I think the real issue...
Let me just interrupt you there. I still think it's possible if these two candidates would do it. I just don't see this coming out of Mark Penn and the campaign strategist working with Hillary Clinton. I still think it's possible for both of them to say, elect me on my merits, and for Hillary Clinton to make a strong argument for her merits that will cause voters to elect her.
Yeah, but that's not what's going on. I think what's I think that what's going on is, if Obama is the nominee for the Democrats and he wins the general election, then Hillary and her investors are out for the next 8 years.
Point made, Mark. I don't see it in such, you know, black and white, almost conspiratorial terms. And frankly, I think that if Hillary does not get this nomination, if Hillary Clinton is not the nominee, that she should replace Harry Reid as the leader of the Senate. Actually, I'd like to see Barbara Boxer replace Harry Reid as the leader of the Senate, but I would have no problem with Hillary Clinton. I mean, she's one tough woman, and she knows how to get things done. And as I said, that's one of the reasons why I think she'd make a good president. Kim in San Francisco. Hey, Kim.
Hey, Tom, you know, one thing that I've admired about you is that you've always had the guts to speak up for things that you believe in individually, apart from the Democratic Party. I am... really tired of pundits at this point. I never thought I'd be this tired of them. It is so typical of the Democrats all by themselves, aside from the punditry, to turn lemonade into lemons, which is what we're doing now. I will be dancing in the voting booth to vote for either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. I will be dancing.
Me too. Me too. And that's one of the reasons why I've, you know, on the show today, we started out talking about global warming. I mean, I am so sick of the punditry. What I'm seeing is a media that wants to drag this thing out because it's incredibly profitable. Enormous amounts of money are being raised. And where's all that money going? It's going right to the mainstream media in advertising. And they're just loving it. The longer they can drag this out, the longer they can have special election report and election central and the big battle and all that kind of stuff. And
the horse race.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And who loses? The Democrats lose. And frankly, I think because the Democrats lose, the American people and the world loses because John McCain is 8 more years of war. The man was formed in war. I give him credit for his service to our country and for the horrific experiences he had. But the reality is that war is the, to paraphrase the title of the book, war is the force that shaped him. And he seems very, very fond of war. And that frightens me.
It makes a lot of money for his very, very close friends. The last thing I want to say, though, Tom, is this. Do not, to all your listeners, either side, Hillary or Barack Obama, do not let the punditry create a civil war here.
It's already going on, Kim.
Let us try to talk.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and let's not get into the you know, here's why the other side is bad. I mean, you wouldn't believe the emails that I get giving the, you know, the 16 god-awful things that Hillary Clinton has done in her life or the 22 reasons why Barack Obama is secretly a fill-in-the-blank, you know.
Right.
And I'm not getting these messages from Republicans. I'm getting them from Democrats.
We have got to stop eating our own here, folks.
That's right. That's right. It is absolutely time. And that's why I have been calling for the better part of the last month and a half or so since it's become, you know, clear that A, Obama is a front runner, and B, that this race is going to get tough, is calling for both of them to run an absolutely positive campaign and give us somebody to vote for, not somebody to vote against or lesser of two evils. Kim, thank you very much. I'm sick of the Clinton bashing. I'm sick of the Obama bashing. None of it does us any good. The pundits on TV say, oh, it makes them stronger candidates. No, it's making John McCain a stronger candidate. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Come, you masters of war. Here they build the big guns. Here they build the death planes. Here they build all the bombs. Here they hide behind walls. it hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks.
Well, what kind of mask are they wearing this week? 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Marjorie Cohn is with us. She is the president of the National Lawyers Guild, a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she teaches criminal law and procedure, evidence, and international human rights law, and is the author of Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Have Defied the Law, and Cameras in the Courtroom, Television in the Pursuit of Justice. Her website, Marjorie Cohn, C-O-H-N, Marjorie, M-A-R-J-O-R-I-E-C-O-H-N.com. And Marjorie Cohn, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Tom.
You are one of my favorite constitutional experts, or just broadly, favorite legal experts. So
well, you're one of my favorite radio talk show hosts, my very favorite.
We have a mutual admiration society here.
Right.
You have written, I believe you wrote this, yeah, yes, no, or perhaps it was written about you. You wrote this, is the Bush administration ramping up for an attack on Iran? Beware an attack on Iran. And the signs seem to point in that direction. Tell us about this.
Well, on March 11th, the commander of the U.S. forces in the Middle East, Navy Admiral William Fallon, retired early over differences with the Bush administration over Iran policy. And now Dick Cheney is touring the Middle East, talking to our Arab allies, and Iran is high on the agenda. Now, John McCain, you know, just came back from a tour in Iraq, Jordan, England, France, looking very presidential with Senator Joe Lieberman attached to his side, joined at the hip. And in fact, there was a statement made by John McCain during a press conference in Jordan, where McCain charged that Iran was training al-Qaeda operatives, and then Lieberman whispered in McCain's ear, and McCain said, "No, that's not true. They're training other people."
Extremists, he said.
Right, exactly, extremists. And people were speculating, well, is he just losing it? Does he not know? Is he too old? And in fact, he was really parroting what the Bush administration has been saying, which is trying to conflate Iran's training of Shia militiamen associated with the Mahdi army with their propaganda theme that Iran is supporting al-Qaeda. And, of course, Iran, the government of Iran is Shiite and al-Qaeda is Sunni, and there is no love lost between them. In fact, Iran handed over 225 suspected al-Qaeda operatives to their country of origin in 2003 and gave their names to the UN. But the fact that McCain is running around with Lieberman at his side, and Lieberman, by the way, is one of the leading advocates of a U.S. military attack on Iran, and I think he's probably going to be McCain's choice for vice presidential running mate. I haven't seen that much.
That's been my guess, the way I've seen them joined at the hip, for not just on this trip. I mean,
for months. I think he thinks he'll get the independents, he'll get the Jewish voters, he'll get the Christian Zionists, because they want to attack Iran.
They'll get the conservative Democrats.
Yes, exactly. And Lieberman is very dangerous. But here you have John McCain, and right at the top of his agenda is trying to beat the drums against Iran. Now, recently, the National Intelligence Estimate unanimously concluded, 16 U.S. intelligence agencies unanimously concluded that Iran is not developing nuclear weapons. Bush immediately denounced that report and said, "I have said Iran is dangerous, and the NIE estimate doesn't do anything to change my opinion about the danger Iran poses to the world. Quite the contrary." Admiral
Which is sort
Fallon,
of a variation on "Don't confuse me with the facts."
Precisely. And Admiral Fallon, he was the commander of the U.S. forces in the Middle East. He wanted to talk to Iran, negotiate with Iran, much like Barack Obama is talking about, and yet the Bush administration, who's been really itching to attack Iran for a long time, in all likelihood forced him to retire early.
Yeah.
The New York Times reported a senior administration official saying that Fallon's comments about U.S.-Iran policy left the perception he had a different foreign policy than the president. So if we put together, if we connect the dots of Fallon's early retirement, McCain's rattling the sabers with Lieberman at his side, the sabers against Iran. Dick Cheney, on this visit around, to the Arab countries and also Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, and he's supposedly trying to achieve peace between Israel and the Palestinians, but he's talking to Saudi Arabia, Oman, Turkey, Iraq, and they said that high on his agenda is the U.S. policy toward Iran. It defies reason to think that they would do that in the middle of a disastrous war in Iraq, where we're going bankrupt because of it, where we've now reached 4,000 as the death toll of U.S. soldiers. That doesn't include the mercenaries. That doesn't include estimates anywhere from 100,000 to 1 million Iraqis who have died. And yet, why would they start another war? They've been itching to attack Iran ever since he put, since he put Iran into his axis of evil. He's been rattling the swords against Iran. In 2003, the government of Iran offered an olive branch to the Bush administration, offering to negotiate on every single item of concern, including recognition of Israel, support for Hezbollah, the nuclear program, all of that, and Bush just poo-pooed it, renounced it, and then lied about it.
He did not officially even reply to it.
Didn't reply to it, and then lied about it. So, I mean, I think that Cheney really wants to attack Iran, and maybe they think, in their distorted way, that if they get us involved in a new war, that'll make McCain look stronger because he has military background. He hasn't really done anything, except, and I'm not denigrating the fact that he was a prisoner of war for 5 years, but he doesn't have any important command responsibilities that would qualify him to be commander-in-chief any more than Barack Obama, for example, or
Hillary
Clinton.
For that matter.
Yeah. But they want to get him in there.
Marjorie, let me pose. We're talking with Marjorie Cohn, the president of the National Lawyers Guild and distinguished professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Her website, MarjorieCohn.com. And let me pose this semi-rhetorical question. I mean, you go back to 1960, Richard Nixon, as vice president, was chairman of the Cuba Task Force, and he organized what later became the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was supposed to be happen in October of 1960 as a way of knocking Kennedy off his perch. One of Kennedy's major attacks on Nixon was that he had allowed Cuba to go communist on his watch. Nixon got himself reelected by using a lie about war and peace, that he had a secret plan for peace in the election of, 72, as I recall. We have seen a series of, certainly I would say the Bush administration, in fact, Tommy Tompkins came out later and said that in the election of 2004 that he kept having to jack up the security alerts for reasons that he didn't understand. Orders came down from the White House, go from orange to red. And, during the month of October, we've seen a series of October surprises. And, of course, the famous October surprise that's still being debated of this part of the Iran-Contra scandal of cutting a deal possibly with Iran to hold the hostages through the election cycle to defeat Jimmy Carter by Ronald Reagan. And it's fairly clear to me that with the timing of this war starting in 2002, just before the 2002 elections, that vote just in October with the elections in November, that this was that there was a very, very large political factor in the timing of this war. To what extent do you think that this might be an October surprise that is designed to set up John McCain? And if so, what do we do about it, and what will it, what will it mean for the political consequence of it be?
That's a very good question, Tom. Look back at the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, where during the Johnson administration, trying to convince us that the North Vietnamese had attacked us first, it turns out it was a big lie, and they are really trying. They're selling fear. That's what they've been selling all along, and I think they're banking. It may well be an October surprise, banking on the assumption that the American people are going to rally around the flag when we're involved in a war, and we're going to hear. I think that we need to look back on all the lies, and I think that the Center for Public Integrity documented 932 lies in the 2 years after 9/11 about alleged weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and Al-Qaeda Saddam Hussein ties coming from high officials in the Bush administration. So I think that we need to look with a jaundiced eye at the fear-mongering that's going to come out of the Bush administration about the so-called danger that Iran poses to us. And and look at it very critically and really preempt their attack on Iran. And that's what you're doing by talking about it, I'm doing by writing about it. We have to make sure that they don't get us into another war, because this would be equally, if not more, disastrous than the mess that they've created in Iraq, which is not going well. The surge is not working.
Well,
people are being killed every day, and they're going bankrupt.
Yeah, we have about 30 seconds left. If I may respectfully correct you, this war is actually going very well for the defense contractors. It's going very well for Halliburton, whose stock price has quadrupled. It's going very well. I mean, there's a small group of people for whom it's a
boon. I agree
boon.
With you completely.
And
yeah.
They would also benefit from a war with Iran.
Absolutely. Because when you use bombs, then you have to buy more.
That's right. And these are the guys behind this administration.
And they'll use the mercenaries. There are more mercenaries in Iraq than there are U.S. soldiers.
Yep.
So it's very, very frightening. We can't let it happen.
More money for Blackwater.
That's right.
Marjorie Cohn. MarjorieCohn.com, the website, CohnCohn. Marjorie, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Good speaking with you. It is 45 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by you, supporting our sponsors, the sponsors you hear on our local station, our national sponsors, such as the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and my traveling companion through southern Sudan and the border region near Darfur, online with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi, Tom. I got to tell you that, first of all, I'm glad you're feeling better, and that makes me feel better.
Thank you.
Because I know you got back and you got the whatever you got.
Yeah.
But there's a lot going on, and the main focus, because Congress is out of session this week, has really been the campaigns. I was privileged or not privileged, depending on your point of view, to be on two conference calls in the last 2 days, one from the Obama campaign, one from the Hillary Clinton campaign. The Hillary Clinton campaign says, no, it is not over. There's still superdelegates. There's still other races, and they think that Hillary can pull it off. They have been very, very critical of the Obama campaign on several issues, and they feel, first of all, General Mattek, as you know, who shot his mouth off talking about McCarthyism and the Clintons. And I got to tell you, I happen to know Mattek. I've interviewed him. If you were to tell me the most arrogant politician in the United States of America, even though he's not a politician, it would be Mattek.
That's interesting. He lives right down the road here from us, and has been on on our morning show. And my sense of him was that he was a decent guy.
Oh my gosh! There's Mattek stories that would go from.
Okay. Well, let's not get into the personal end of it.
You know, but what I'm saying is that I actually predicted that it would be a while until he said something, and he did. So the Clinton people are after Mattek. The Mattek people, I mean the Obama people, were after Clinton this morning like nothing I have ever heard. And first of all, she's raised almost what 150, 140. She's raised a lot of money in her total campaign. And there, the Obama people are going after the fact, well, she's got $750,000 from PACs, and you know, she's gotten money from
Political Action Committee's PACs. Right?
Exactly. And they're after her like you can't believe it. And I want to say, Obama people, you're looking for, you're looking for things.
Right.
Just, you know, kind of stick with it.
Somebody needs to say,
so nasty out
right,
there.
Somebody needs to say to both of them, it's, you know, give us a reason to vote for you. We can, you know, we will learn all the reasons to vote against you in the fall, and we probably already have, or to vote against your opponent, rather. But please give us reasons to vote for you. And you know, the civil campaign that we saw a month or so ago, 2 months ago, you know, that moment, those several moments during the one-on-one debate, the one before the last one, if we could only recapture that, you know, but it, tragically it seems to have vanished. I saw it, you know, I mean, it vanished on the Clinton side, I would say, first, but you're suggesting now that it's vanished on the Obama side as well.
Exactly. And you just don't understand. I mean, they are completely destroying each other, the Democratic Party, and, as you say, give me a reason to vote for you. So that's sort of on the campaign issue. Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing that people have not been paying attention to too much are, you know, people aren't paying that much attention to what Bush is doing because he's on his way out, other than making war with the 4,000 people. I'm sure you've been talking about it and the number of injured and all that kind of stuff. But he is meeting tomorrow with the King of Bahrain. Now, most people might say, other than the fact that we've staged the war from part of Bahrain, why is this so important? Well, when I was in Dubai last week, it's interesting that Bahrain is now trying to change all of their financial structures, all of the way that they're doing business. What happens on, you know, Thursday nights and Fridays, which is the Muslim weekend, so that it is much more European and American friendly to business to begin to take some of the business away from UAE.
Hmm. Interesting.
And so when I saw that on the president's schedule, I thought, now this is very, very interesting because, of course, you have Halliburton that went to UAE, to Dubai in specific. And now what is going to go on? Because Bahrain, other than our bases, which are important, obviously, the other issue is what is happening to American business and how is yet another country in the Middle East going to pay attention to that?
Well, and you have, I mean, with this giant bailout that just happened of Bear Stearns, or that might be happening, you know, apparently it's up and
down. Now they're going to pay $10 a share or something, right?
Yeah, well, there's a discussion about it, but it's, you know, I mean, there is a number of banks and non-banking institutions who should not, hang on just a second, pardon
exactly.
me, I had to cough. There's a bunch of non-banking institutions that historically would not have access to federal funds. Fed funds that are being given access to Fed funds basically just to prevent them from falling through the floor. And you start looking at them and you find that significant minority stockholders, I mean, some of the major stockholders in these companies are the sheikhs in the Middle East. Are we bailing them out? I mean, is that part of the deal?
Well, I certainly know that if you look at what happened in Dubai the other day when I was there, when the Fed reduced their rates, Dubai did. And why is that? Because UAE did, because so many of their dollars were invested in the U.S. housing market.
Wow. Yeah. So, see, that's my point. And so if we bail out the bankers, we're bailing out the Middle Eastern countries that have used all the surplus money that we're giving them for oil to invest in these crazed investment vehicles. Nobody whose home is being foreclosed on is being bailed out, but the billionaire sheikhs who are good friends with the Bush family, they're getting bailed out. And this seems
well.
I
think what we are going to see, and that's what I said when I saw that on the president's schedule. I said, "This is interesting."
Yeah, yeah.
For that
your observations are always extraordinarily perceptive, Ellen Ratner. Thank you, and thanks again for the great week that we spent.
In
Sudan. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News. And by the way, there's great video and audio of our trip to Africa over at talkradionews.com. Check it out. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Call 866-303-2270. Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. What is this thing called liberal? Eric Alterman, author of the national bestseller, What Liberal Media? His website, ericalterman.com, the author of numerous previous books. In fact, he even co-authored a book with Air America's Mark Green, the book on Bush. Yeah, he's also the author of six previous books. What Liberal Media is one of the better known ones. When Presidents Lie, distinguished professor of English at Brooklyn College at the City University of New York, professor of journalism at the Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And hopefully you're a little more articulate than I am today.
I'll try.
Running on Robitussin again. I love the questions that you use as chapter headers in your book. Why do liberals hate patriotism? Let's, in the 12 or so minutes here that we have, or maybe it's a little less than that, let's just see how many of these we can go through, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
Give people a taste of your book, and I encourage them to run right out and buy it. Why were liberals a political handbook for post-Bush America? Why do liberals hate patriotism?
Well, I guess because they're bad people.
Seriously, I mean, you know, this rhetorical question.
Seriously, the book is set up. It's really two books. The first third of the book is an attempt to explain what is liberalism, what does it look like, and how did it get into the situation that we're in now.
Right.
The second part of the book, which is the part to which you're referring, is an attempt to answer all of the accusations made by conservatives and repeated ad nauseum in the mainstream media about liberals, which, in my view, are more often than not truer about conservatives than they are liberals. There is some truth to some of them. It's not that they're all myths. But they apply, in most cases, far better to conservatives than liberals.
So maybe we should start then with the notion of liberalism. What does it mean to be a liberal?
Well, see, one big problem liberalism has. Can you hear me all right, by the way?
Yeah, more or less.
I'm in a kind of noisy Starbucks.
Yeah, I can tell.
One of the problems that liberalism has is that it's a little bit difficult to define. And conservatism is rather easy to define. Though conservatives tend to ignore what conservatism is when they get into power. But what liberalism means to me is it's the legacy of the Enlightenment. It's the right of everyone to follow their own conscience, to do what they believe in, to become who they want to be, and to not worry about what God says, or the king says, or the church says, or the dictatorship of the proletariat says, or the fatherland says.
At least in the context of public political discourse.
Well, and then, no, but in any sense.
Yeah.
In other words, it's fine for you if you believe in God and be a religious person. I'm a relatively religious person myself. But it's not fine for you to say, we're going to make public policy on the basis of my religious beliefs on what God tells me to do.
Right, that was my point. Yeah.
Right, which is what George W. Bush frequently says. Now, that definition of liberalism, which is the classical definition of liberalism, would actually include a lot of conservatives. The ones who aren't sort of part of the Christian fundamentalist right, like Milton Friedman and Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan would probably endorse a lot of that. But the second part of liberalism, the part that developed since the New Deal, is the idea that says there are a lot of powerful forces in our society that prevent people from achieving all these things, from being all these things, from being who they would like to be, from giving everyone a fair shot. And we need to create institutions as a society to make it possible for all of us to do this. In other words, we need a government that's on your side. We need a civil society that's on your side. We need institutions like labor unions that are on your side in order to counteract these other forces like big business, like foreign military governments, like the military itself, that have interests that are antithetical to those of the individual.
Right. So you go through all these, you know, these negative stereotypes of liberals. Do you want to address some of these and get into?
I mean, there's about 20 or so chapters where I point out that actually the rap that's made against liberals is actually much more effectively made against conservatives. Off the top of my head, you know, I think it's interesting that conservatives keep increasing the size of government as Republican presidents, whereas Democratic presidents keep decreasing the size of government. George Bush has increased it from roughly 20% of the economy to 23%, which is a very, very big jump. Bill Clinton reduced it. Not that Bill Clinton's liberal, but he's more liberal than George Bush.
Now, I've heard conservatives say, yeah, that's because he had to deal with the Republican Congress. It was actually Newt Gingrich who did that.
Yeah, well, they'd be wrong about that.
Okay.
I mean, the tax bill, which is what did it more than anything, was passed without any Republican support at all.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about balancing the budget. There was not one single Republican who voted for it.
Yeah. Now, I'll give you another example. Judicial activism. We're always hearing about how horrible liberal judges are because they're so activist. But in fact, if you take, again, you just do calmly take the numbers, look at the number of congressional laws that have been overturned by the Supreme Court. Look at the number of legal precedents that have been overturned by the Supreme Court. A significant majority of these were done by judges appointed Republican presidents rather than Democratic presidents. On and on down the line. Republicans talk a very good game when it comes to patriotism and the military, but in fact, they've misused the military. They've abused the military. And Democrats have shown much more respect for the military. The Democrats don't send the military to fight without body armor, without protection for their vehicles. They don't cut their veterans' benefits so that people have to take up welfare collections for injured veterans in their towns. They didn't stretch, I mean, they did stretch the military in Vietnam. The liberals made a lot of mistakes in the 60s and 70s. But it's George Bush is destroying the institution today.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are some conservatives who would disavow. Eric, the phone is just really bad. I'm gonna wrap this up now. But I just want to remind our listeners here, our listeners in Portland, that you'll be here Thursday, the 27th, at Powell's, signing your book, Why We're Liberals, A Political Handbook for Post-Bush America. And I assume that means that you're on tour?
Yes, I'll be in Portland, and then I'll be in San Francisco, Berkeley tomorrow night, San Francisco on the next day, Portland the day after that, and Seattle the day after that.
Great. We're on the air in all those cities, so people can check it out. The book, Why We're Liberals. That's okay. Eric, thanks so much for being with us. Why We're Liberals, a political handbook for post-Bush America by Eric Alterman. In today's Financial Times, there's a cloud here on the horizon that I wanted to point out and that really concerns me. The headline, this is from the front page of the second section. I remember I shared with you the article from the front page of the first section of today's Financial Times. There are actually two. One of them was about how the World Food Program is asking for an emergency $500 million. The other one from the front page is how Tokyo, the Japanese government, which is very concerned about face, they would never want to lecture us in public, are lecturing us in public. And in fact, in the article by Michio Nakamoto in Tokyo, the headline, Tokyo should use U.S., says U.S. should use public funds to resolve mortgage crisis. The U.S. should inject public funds into its financial system, which is undergoing a worse crisis than that experienced by Japan. See, their concern is the old saying, you know, when America gets a cold, Japan gets the flu or the pneumonia or whatever. And they go on, although it is very difficult for Japan to convey such a message to a foreign government. There's that face thing. Japan could, for example, convey through the G7 meeting of finance ministers or central bank governors meeting Japan's lesson and that we are prepared to take coordinated action if necessary to help resolve the situation, said Mr. Watanabe, Yoshimi Watanabe, who is with the, let's see. That doesn't designate his position with the Japanese government, but he's apparently with the Japanese government. And he said the world's huge excess liquidity has started flowing out of the U.S. If that flow were to be extended, it could lead to unprecedented problems. He said one thing is to fix the hole in the bathtub, but we must recognize that the current crisis is not as straightforward as past dollar crisis. So what they're saying is if they're talking about liquidity flowing out of the United States, they're talking about a financial disaster coming to the United States. And then the second one is this one from the front page of the second section of the paper, and I will probably have to share the rest of it with you right after the break. But the headline, Security Estimates Revealed, and here it is, the first public price estimates for specific structured credit securities to have emerged since the start of the crisis, of the credit crisis, are now out. For the very first time, literally for the very first time, we're starting to get some small inkling of how bad this thing is and what the real value of some of these securities are and some of these banking institutions and perhaps what we can do about it. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Carrington. Excuse me. Carrington seeks to replace its bank loans. Carrington Capital Management, a $1 billion hedge fund, this is from today's Financial Times again, specializing in mortgages, is trying to persuade its investors to lend it $200 million. Now, let me get this straight. Here is a hedge fund. This is a company that you invest money in, right? So let's say that you took, let's say that you did like George W. Bush says. You know, instead of privatizing Social Security, as quote retirement end quote, even though we realize it's much more than that, and you put your life savings into Carrington Capital Management, this hedge fund, and they called you up and they said we'd like you to loan us some money. This is a $1 billion fund. They're looking for a $200 million loan, which means a 20% loan. So say you gave them $100,000, your life savings, they call you up and they say, we'd like to borrow $20,000 from you. Otherwise, probably you're going to lose your whole $100,000. And by the way, we'll pay you an 18% interest rate on it. At that point, I would run screaming into the street. I mean, or the economic equivalent, I'd say, give me back all my money, please. Because when somebody offers you 18% return on a loan, you know they're in trouble. Now, this is a British company. See, the Brits have been doing the same thing we have. Maggie Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush notion of, and it was Clinton, actually, who signed the legislation that killed the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act was put into place in 1934, as I recall, during the Roosevelt administration. Might have been earlier than that. It might have been 33. It was certainly proposed in 33. And it was one of the first pieces of legislation that went through that said that banks have to be banks, and people who want to gamble, people who want to speculate, people who want to invest, they have to be a separate kind of entity. And only the banks will be protected by the FDIC and by the government. We're going to protect the banking system. But we're not going to protect people who are out there gambling with their money. And that Glass-Steagall Act prevented banks from getting into the gambling business, which meant that they couldn't be as profitable. They were profitable, but it was boring profitable. You'd have a nice, predictable, 5-10% a year return on equity in your stock and your bank, and that was it. And bankers were, nice, boring, predictable people. And they were just chomping at the bit, like Enron, with energy, to say, no, we want to be more than that. We want to be bigger than that. We want to be different than that. We want to be investors. So you end up with companies that are worth $200-300 million that go out and borrow, literally, I'm not making this up, $20 billion based on their $200-300 million in equity, in value. Go out and borrow $20 billion, and with that $20 billion of borrowed money, they're buying these bundled home loans and variations and pieces of them. And when they drop in value, say if they drop in value 10%, on $20 billion, you just lost $2 billion. Well, your whole company was only worth $200 million to start out with. And this is what happened to Bear Stearns. This is what's happening, not using those exact numbers, but very similar. And this is what's happening. This is what's happening with Carrington Capital Management over in the UK. The first estimates are coming out now as a result of this lawsuit that is happening. Some securities, this is another article, securities estimates revealed by Gill and Tent, today's Financial Times. Some securities have lost almost a third of their value for the first time we're seeing, even though they were considered so safe that they carried top-notch ratings. These were rated AAA. Meanwhile, some subprime mortgage-linked securities issued by groups such as UBS have lost almost 95% of their value. So you get a bank that, because of the Glass-Steagall Act, can now get into investments rather than just banking. They can get into gambling. You get you know, this merger. And they go out and they, so let's say that their total capitalization is $1 billion, and they go out and they borrow and you know, they leverage is the word, you know, about $10 billion worth of these securities. Now they've lost 95% of their value, so they're worth $1 billion, but they are $9 billion, $9.5 billion in debt now. What are you going to do? You know, it's the old joke, the old that every small business person in America knows. You know, if you owe your bank $10,000 and you can't pay it back, you've got a problem. If you owe your bank $10 million and you can't pay it back, your bank has a problem. And that's what's happened, because we stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, because Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. These agencies, these financial agencies, got so big that they were, quote, too big to fail, which is a euphemism for saying if they fail, then the taxes of average, ordinary, middle-class people, and it's people, by the way, corporations are only paying 7.4% of the total tax load in this country, compared to 32% back in 1950. It's the average people who are going to bail them out, rather than having the billionaires fail. God forbid the billionaires should fail. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You walk too high. I can't see. Can't seem to reach you. Can't set you free. If you can help me, follow the sound.
Four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. By the way, a reminder that, you know, health willing, the airplane gods and all that sort of thing. I will be this Friday broadcasting live from KMPT 930 in Missoula, Montana. And also at 2 p.m., I'll be giving a talk at the Holiday Inn Parkside at 200 South Patty Street in Missoula. The talk is free and open to the public, and I will be signing copies of my books. So that should be great fun. That's Friday, March 28th. You will recall, well, actually, let me set this up here.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why.
Our lives in the balance.
Tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the camp. And there is blood on the wild.
So you recall about a week ago, Dick Cheney was asked by an ABC News reporter, you know, what do you think about the fact that the majority of the country wants to get out of Iraq? He said, or disapproves of the war in Iraq. And he said, so? Well, it gets worse. It gets even more bizarre. The ABC correspondent, Martha Raddatz, was traveling with Dick Cheney in the Middle East this last week. And this must have been Easter, because she said, I want to start with the milestone today of 4,000 dead in Iraq, Americans. And just what effect do you think it has on our country? Cheney said, I am quoting him, these are his exact words, the president carries the biggest burden, obviously. He's the one who has to make the decision to commit young Americans, but we are fortunate to have a group of men and women, the all-volunteer force, who voluntarily put on the uniform and go in harm's way for the rest of us. So then she said, well, when you talk about the all-volunteer, and I'm quoting Martha Raddatz now, she said, when you talk about an all-volunteer force, some of these soldiers, airmen, Marines, have been on 2, 3, 4, some of them more than that, deployments. Do you think when they volunteered, they had any idea there would be so many deployments or stop loss? Some of those who want to get out can't get out because of the stop loss. And this was Cheney's response. I'm telling you, this man is a sociopath. Quote, a lot of men and women sign up because sometimes they will see developments. Like, oh, they're signing up for adventure. We'll give them adventure. He continues. For example, 9/11 stimulated a lot of folks to volunteer for the military because they wanted to be involved in defending the country. Yeah, I think that's why people join the military. But they don't expect the kind of leadership that these guys have provided us with, shall we say. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Dick in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind?
Hi. I'm going to be voting here in Pennsylvania next month in the primary.
Right.
And I feel very much the way you do, that either Hillary or Barack would make a great president. I need to make a decision, however.
Yeah.
And I think if they would answer some questions about immunity for the phone companies or the detainees at Guantanamo or secret prisons, on and on and on, it would be easier.
This is where I would love to see a debate between these two candidates about, you should vote for me because of this stand on this issue versus that stand on that issue, that kind of thing, rather than, oh, my God, look at his preacher, or, oh, my God,
right,
you know, look at her, the advisor, the head of her campaign, you know, who's associated with head of John McCain's campaign or whatever. I mean, you know, conspiracy theory of the week, number 37.
Right.
And you're absolutely right. And I keep challenging, trying to challenge. And frankly, let me say, I am... Barack Obama was here in Portland over the weekend. I think it was Thursday or Friday. I was so sick this last week. It's all a blur, but I watched his speech on television, and he did deal with those issues, and he did say that he intends to restore habeas corpus, and he did say that he is going to put an end to the spying by the telephone companies on us, and that it is absolutely wrong to be doing. And he did say that this is unconstitutional. This is a guy who is a professor of constitutional law. He has explicitly said these things, and I believe that Hillary Clinton, to a large extent, has explicitly said these things as well, although I haven't heard her speak. You know, I've never heard her give a speech, a stump speech. I've only heard him give one once, and that was the one here in Portland. And I wasn't there, but they carried it live on all the TV channels here, and I watched it. Dick, I don't envy your position. I can tell you, you know, in my own mind, if I had to vote today, I'm fairly well concluded who I would vote for. And that said, I want to give, you know, as well, I guess I should do this the way I did before. You know, when there were a whole field of candidates, I said, you know, at that time, I said, I'm not going to endorse any particular candidate. My favorite was John Edwards. I liked what Dennis Kucinich had to say. I didn't think he had the disposition, the personality necessarily to be a great president, but he had certainly had the policies. But I thought John Edwards had both. I was a little wary of both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But Edwards was my favorite, but I wasn't endorsing him by any means because I thought, you know, anybody but Mike Gravel, he was the only one that I thought was, you know, that I couldn't have voted for under any circumstances, or not under any circumstance, but, you know, that I would have had a hard time voting for because of some of the outrageous things he said on our show. He was just a little nutty, I think.
Right.
That any of them were okay with me. And, you know, I'm pretty much at that place right now. I'm personally, you know, kind of leaning in the direction of thinking that, particularly given the way the campaigns have been conducted and particularly given the discourse and the rhetoric, that Barack Obama is a very, very powerful candidate and that he could be, as a president, a truly transformational president for this country, which I think is a wonderful and positive thing.
Right.
I'm kind of leaning in that direction. But that said, if Hillary Clinton can figure out some way to pull this thing out, even if it's by hook or crook, and I don't mean something illegal, but I mean, you know, working the system, then maybe she's the one who should go up against John McCain, because the Republicans are going to, you know, they're going to empty the bag. I mean, they're going to throw everything at the candidate, and we want to be sure that the very strongest candidate is the one who emerges. So I got to move along, Dick, but thanks for your call. I appreciate it. It's Laird in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Laird, what's on your mind?
I've talked to you about this before on the Peter Beek show about democracy being messy.
And it's a good thing.
And it's a good thing, exactly. And I think it was H.L. Mencken that said something about, give me a sloppy government because an orderly government is usually very authoritarian.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, Mussolini was famous for making the trains run on time, even though he actually didn't make the trains run on time. That's what he was famous
for. And I'm not trying to compare Bush to fascism, although there are people who may go there. But the fact is, when everybody's in step, it shows me that nobody's thinking.
It's
just such a basic thing, we tend to forget it.
Yeah.
So the point here is that I don't think we should be too upset over a little arguing messiness. I mean, I know there's a point where it could be damaging, but on the other hand, that is our system.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, you know, right now, the good point, and thank you very much, Laird, for making it. Right now, Pat Buchanan has an op-ed out. The Republicans are doing everything they can. Sean Hannity, wall to wall, all these other guys, excuse me, are doing everything they can to portray Barack Obama as, quote, the black guy, end quote. You know, it's to hyper-focus on race and racial issues using this opportunity that was presented by Reverend Wright. Whereas prior to this time, he had been above that is probably the wrong word, but his campaign had not been focused on race, shall we say, and had rather been focused on all the issues. And all those issues were being discussed and were being talked about. And the extent to which the Republicans can make him about race or they can make Hillary about being a woman. I mean, I can tell you the campaign commercial that is going to run in the fall, if Hillary is the nominee, we know the one that's going to run in the fall if Barack Obama is the nominee. It's going to be Reverend Wright, you know, screaming about how he does, you know, he's upset about America. And in fact, you read it in context, you watch the whole thing in context, and he very much is not upset about America. The guy was a Marine. He helped when Lyndon Johnson had his gallbladder surgery in 1966, as a photo of Reverend Wright. He was, you know, in the military at the time, standing there at his bedside, helping as a medic, you know, helping put him back together. But in any case, that the ad for the anti-Obama ad will be Wright, and the anti-Hillary Clinton ad will be an ad that's a variation on. So, you think Laura Bush is qualified to be president? Was Jackie Kennedy qualified to be president? You know, that's how they're going to cast it. They're going to say, you know, oh, she was the wife of the president. That's no qualification for president. And you just know that the Republicans are going to come with this crap, frankly. I mean, it's just, they're going to come, you know, with these attacks no matter what. So it's really important that right now these candidates be portraying themselves in ways that wrap them in the issues, so that when the Republicans come with these below-the-belt attacks, people go, ah, come on, I heard that stuff before, but I know that Hillary actually stands for A, B, and C, or Barack Obama actually stands for A, B, and C, and the voters can get beyond that. And that's what's not happening right now, and it's a tragedy. 45 minutes past.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
Now, Daddy didn't like trouble, but if it came along, everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on. He never was a hero, for this county's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right. He'd say, you've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything. You've got to be your own man, not a puppet on a string. Never compromise what's right, and uphold your family name. You've got to stand for something, or you fall for anything.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a little reminder, this is Dinka, this language. These are mostly Dinka people. That was great. There was a lot to love out of that trip, as horrific as so many of the things we saw were. And I encourage you to go over and check out our website. We've got links to some of the photos over at Talk Radio News and other places at tomhartman.com. 1-866-303-2270. Anthony in Seattle. Hey, Anthony.
Oh, hi, Tom. I was just hoping that that drumming sound that they were pounding on was like a papier-mâché head of Bush.
Yeah.
What I wanted to essentially kind of parrot about what you were just discussing earlier was the fact that both the House and Senate banking committees are allowing, you know, the Democrats took control of Congress in 2006 overwhelmingly, and it's like, what have they done is my question, and I'm sick of hearing this. It takes 60 votes to override a, yeah, you know, a blah, blah, blah.
Well, and plus the other big problem is everybody's afraid, and perhaps appropriately so, I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm not a hyper-political insider in Washington, D.C., but the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act was done on the Clinton administration at the, you know, at the strong encouragement of Bill Clinton and members in his administration, several of whom were from major investment banks and are now back at the head of those major investment banks, and multimillionaires and billionaires, and Bill hasn't done it so bad for himself since he left office either. And I don't mean that as an indictment of any of these guys. I believe that they believed at the time that what they were doing was opening up opportunities for people to make more money and that that would be a good thing for the economy. But what in fact they did is they took us back to the conditions, the regulatory environment that existed in the United States in the 1920s, and which brought about, you know, particularly as banks were speculating in investments in 1929, 1930, 31, brought about so many crashes that you had these horrible runs on the banks. And in 1933, this legislation was put into place to say banks are a sacred and unique type of business. They have its own kind of regulation, and they can't do these things.
I guess what all I want to see, and I think all of us who are Democrats or left-leaning, we just want to see, you know, yes, we want to see the war ended, but we want to see a change. And by change, I mean we need a Henry Waxman in charge of the Banking Committee in the Senate.
Yep.
We need to get rid of Harry Reid. You know, that's the kind of change we want to see. We're sick of these mealy-mouthed, you know, whiny,
Yeah, no, I get it. Although Henry Waxman is in the House of Representatives, but, you know, wouldn't it be great if he were in the Senate? There are people like him in the Senate, Barbara Boxer, Russ Feingold. I mean, there are some very, very powerful voices. But Anthony, your point is well taken. And in fact, speaking of senators, I mean, here's Chuck Hagel, the Republican Chuck Hagel, talking about, well, wasn't the surge successful? Most Americans believe the surge is successful. See, the big lie's been repeated so many times. And Chuck Hagel says,
We have lost over 900 dead Americans since the surge. Now, if you want to dismiss that as success, that'll be your interpretation. The fact is, in the end, all that matters is not a military tactical victory. Of course, when you flood the zone with American firepower, which is superior to anything in the world, we have the best soldiers, the best led, best equipped.
But there's you didn't be... think that would work at
no,
the time.
No, that's not what I said. That's not what I said. I said what you will do is you will further bog yourselves down into a situation, making the Iraqis more dependent on you, making it more difficult to get out. In the end, you're not going to be any closer to a political reconciliation. If all of this is working so well, George, then why are the Bush administration now talking about keeping brigades in there at 140,000, larger than what we had in there when the surge started? Why did General Petraeus say last week, General Petraeus, that there has not been commensurate political progress? That, in the end, is all that's going to matter anyway. What the surge was all about, George, was trying to buy time for the Iraqis. They've not used that time very well.
It's Chuck Hagel with George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week. I mean, you know, so there it is. It's just straightforward. Kara in Seattle. Hey, Kara, what's up?
Hi there. I just want to say I will not vote for Clinton no matter what, especially anymore. It's getting really ridiculous. Now,
why?
I'm actually an independent, registered independent in Washington, like probably one-third of all Americans at this point.
Or more.
And yeah. The Democrats, you know, just really need to get it together. We have a political shop in Seattle. One of the buttons we sell says, "Hey, Dems, grow a set, would you?" You know, I mean, really, stand up to these people. Show us that you're really different. I just don't believe, especially anymore, that Clinton is really that much different. I want more than anything to see a woman in office. But, you know, she's not it, and not right now. This sense of entitlement. I have hardcore Democrat friends who are so mad at the Clintons. They are so not for Clinton at all.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and in our shop, it's mostly
and
Obama.
Isn't that a tragedy? I mean, Kara, thank you for your call. I mean, that's the tragedy of it. After Barack Obama gave his speech here in Portland, I was so blown away by his speech, but that I went to his website and gave him $100. I am now waiting. I am hoping for an opportunity to hear a speech from Hillary Clinton that will cause me to go to her website and give her $100. We'll see. Coming up tomorrow, Sam Harris, author of The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation, and I will be having a conversation, shall we say. Dar Jamail is going to drop by, talk about the war in Iraq as it enters its sixth year, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.